spots up for grabs. Here's a look at what the opening day roster could look like. Starting pitching, Jose Quintana, Luis Severino, Sean Manea, Adrian Hauser, Tyler McGill. In the bullpen will be Edwin Diaz, Adam Ottaviano, Brooks Raley, Drew Smith, George Lopez, and Sean Reed Foley. Pete Alonso, Jeff McNeil, Francisco Lindor, Brett Beatty, and Joey Wendell in the infield. And in the outfield, Brandon Nimmo, Harrison Bader, Starling Marte, and Tyrone Taylor. And we have a lot of sports on the air today, a lot of baseball. So we will tell you, if you've gotten up early and happen to be watching ESPN, you're seeing the Dodgers and San Diego in Korea, 6 a.m. And that'll be 6 a.m. tomorrow also, San Diego at Los Angeles and ESPN. 4 p.m. spring training San Francisco versus LA Angels, split squad MLB. 6:30 p.m. spring training Pittsburgh versus the New York Yankees on the YES Radio YES Network. 9 p.m. spring training Los Angeles split squad versus Kansas City MLB. In college men's basketball, 6:40 p.m. NCAA tournament, Grambling State versus Montana State, first four game on True TV. 7 p.m., the NIT tournament, St. Joseph at Seton Hall, first round, ESPN2. At 9 p.m., NIT tournament, VCU at Villanova, first round, ESPN2. And back to the NCAA tournament, Colorado versus Boise State, first out, four game, that's on True TV. In college women, NCAA tournament, Presbyterian versus Sacred Heart, first four game on ESPNU, that's 7 p.m. 9 p.m. NCAA tournament, Columbia versus Vanderbilt, first four game, ESPNU. In the NBA, two games, 7:30 p.m., Milwaukee at Boston, ESPN, NBC Sports. And at 10 p.m., Memphis at Golden State, that is on ESPN. And in hockey, 7:30 p.m., Toronto at Washington, that's on TNT. 10 p.m., Minnesota at Los Angeles, that's on TNT. And I think I have about a minute left here, so I'll just read this little article. The College Football Playoff and ESPN announced a $7.8 billion deal Tuesday that will give the network exclusive rights to the expanded postseason through the 2031 season, with the national championship game moving to ABC starting in 2026. Specific financial terms weren't announced, but as previously reported, the new six-year agreement will pay the CFP and participating conferences $1.3 billion annually. That's it for the sports for today. I'm Bill Murphy. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you have a great day, everybody, and please stay safe.
Thanks for spending this part of your day with Chris, Connecticut's Talking News Stand.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup on Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
Hello, everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 20th. I am Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. We'll take a look at the pictures on the front pages of each paper. The main picture on the front page of the Times, I'll read the caption, Rebuffing Washington, the Israeli leader, Netanyahu, said there was no other option other than to invade Rafah. And the picture is a whole bunch of people, many, many people in a crowd waiting to get food in Jabalia on Tuesday. They're women, children, men, all there trying to get some food. Well, I'm going to have that story first from the New York Times over to the Hartford Courant. I'll read the caption and describe the pictures of Westerly Morris Men, a traditional English singing group from Rhode Island, celebrates the organization's 38th annual Vernal Equinox Sunrise Dance at the summit of Lantern Hill in North Stonington on Tuesday morning. The equinox, when the sun is directly over the equator, marks the beginning of the astronomical spring. The Westerly Morris Men are celebrating their 50th year, and the group will be dancing at its annual early morning May Day event on May 1st at Connecticut College in New London. And there's three panels here. One of them is just pretty much silhouettes of the men. So I guess it's at sundown, and they are dancing. There's about five of them there. They're in their garb, green vests, white pants, black hat. There's another picture of one in particular, Morris Mann, I guess you would call, doing a dance. And then the other one is a picture of about five or six of them doing dances. There is no story on that. So those are the pictures on the front page of the Hartford Courant. And we're going to go now to the Times, and we'll start with that story about Netanyahu, who plans to invade Rafah. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel on Tuesday brushed aside President Biden's opposition to a planned ground invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah, saying that his government would press ahead despite pleas for restraint from the United States and key allies. Mr. Netanyahu made the remarks to Israeli lawmakers a day after speaking by phone with Mr. Biden, who reiterated his stance against an offensive into Rafah, arguing that it could be disastrous for the people there and that Israel had other ways of achieving its objective of defeating Hamas. At the president's request, Mr. Netanyahu agreed to send a team of Israeli officials to Washington to hear U.S. concerns and to discuss Rafah, but a day later, he insisted there was no alternative. Sending troops into the city is necessary, Mr. Netanyahu said on Tuesday, to eliminate Hamas battalions in the city. I made it as clear as possible to the president that we are determined to complete the elimination of these battalions in Rafah, and there is no way to do this without a ground incursion, Mr. Netanyahu said. The Israeli leader acknowledged the dispute with the Biden administration and said that Israel was engaged, this is a quote, in a dual campaign, unquote, one military and one diplomatic. The diplomatic fight gives us the time and the resources to reach the full results of the war, he said. A spokesman for the U.S. State Department, Vedant Patel, said of Mr. Netanyahu's comments, "We are just squarely in a different place and have a different viewpoint. The administration believes there are alternative approaches and that would target the key elements of Hamas," he said, "and would do so without a major ground operation in Rafah." Israel's military campaign has killed more than 31,000 people in the Gaza Strip, according to the territory's health officials, and the prospect of a military incursion into Rafah, where more than a million civilians are sheltering, has raised alarms about more civilians being caught in the crossfire. Fleeing from Israeli attacks has become a grim cycle for civilians in Gaza. Israeli evacuation orders have prompted more than a million people to move from one destination to another since October, each time packing belongings and seeking transport, vehicle, cart, or on foot, to escape airstrikes and ground fighting between Israel and Hamas. After following evacuation orders, civilians have often found themselves at new locations, either engulfed in fighting, subject to airstrikes, or without adequate food, water, shelter, sanitation, and other essentials. Jake Sullivan, Mr. Biden's national security advisor, said on Monday that Israel had not presented any plan for ensuring that people fleeing an offensive into Rafah would have anywhere safe to go. It would lead to more civilian deaths, worsen the already dire humanitarian crisis, Mr. Sullivan told reporters, describing the argument the president made to Mr. Netanyahu. A group of experts convened by the United Nations warned on Monday that food shortages were so severe that famine was imminent and that the enclave was on the verge of a major acceleration of deaths and malnutrition. The United States Human Rights Chief Volker Turk blamed Israel on Tuesday for what he said was the entirely preventable catastrophe of starvation unfolding in Gaza. The situation of hunger, starvation, and famine is a result of Israel's extensive restrictions on the entry and the distribution of humanitarian aid and commercial goods, displacement of most of the population, as well as the destruction of crucial civilian infrastructure, Mr. Turk said in a statement. Israel has pushed back on criticism that it is restricting aid from entering Gaza, pointing to its support for several recent initiatives, including efforts to provide supplies by air and sea that aid groups say are far less efficient than road. Israel also accuses Hamas of diverting aid and of using Palestinian civilians as human shields. And another story here is from Berlin. Israel, though heavily dependent on support from the United States, Germany, and other Western nations, has been noticeably out of step with them when it comes to relations with Russia during its war of conquest in Ukraine. Long before Hamas attacked Israel from Gaza on October 7, the country refused Ukrainian requests to send arms or to apply widespread sanctions on Russia, including stopping flights to the country, despite the eagerness of President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, himself Jewish, to visit the country and show solidarity after the attack. He has never made the trip. The reasons reflect Israel's unique security needs and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's delicate relationship with President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia, a primary supporter of Israel's enemies in the region whom Israel cannot afford to offend. As Israel's war with Hamas enters its sixth month, Mr. Netanyahu needs Mr. Putin's goodwill to help constrain Iran in particular and to continue to strike Iranian targets in Syria while trying to avoid harming the forces Russia maintains there. So Mr. Netanyahu has consistently given the Russian leader wide latitude, even at the risk of alienating Israel's allies in Europe and the United States. Israel is playing on a delicate tightrope, said Emmanuel Nevan, the Israel-based executive director of Elnet Israel, a non-governmental organization that seeks to strengthen diplomatic ties between Israel and Europe. But even as Israel treads lightly when it comes to Russia, the relationship remains vastly lopsided. Mr. Putin has been a vocal critic of Israel, using condemnation of Israel's war in Gaza to appeal to the Global South, a term for an informal group of developing and underdeveloped countries, some of whom have been critical of the United States, Europe, and the current world order. And I have one more story from the Times. For many civilians in Gaza, fleeing from Israeli attacks has become a grim cycle. Israeli evacuation orders have prompted more than 1 million people to move from one destination to another since October, each time packing belongings and seeking transport by vehicle, car, or foot to escape airstrikes and ground fighting between Israel and Hamas. The latest example is Rafah in southern Gaza, a city swollen to more than 1.4 million people by displacement. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said on Tuesday that his military would invade the city to root out Hamas and facilitate an orderly exit of the population. Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, has said that a major ground invasion by Rafah would be a mistake, not least because it would further imperil humanitarian access. Displacement has contributed to a hunger crisis sweeping the territory, and the United Nations has said that an invasion could mean that Gaza slides deeper into the abyss. Some civilians say they have fled time and again, as many people face the prospect of being displaced again. Here is a look at what happened on a few occasions when Israel has told civilians to evacuate. Israel began telling more than 1 million civilians to evacuate northern Gaza about 2 weeks ahead of its ground invasion on October 27, though the area was pummeled by Israeli airstrikes soon after the Hamas-led attack in Israel on October 7. Hamas is using you as a human shield, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, an Israeli military spokesman, said on October 22nd, calling on civilians to move south. The Israeli military also dropped Arabic language leaflets over the area, warning that anyone who did not move south may be considered as a partner in a terrorist organization. The United Nations said the evacuation order was impractical, and the U.S. asked Israel to delay its invasion to give civilians more time. Hundreds of thousands of people moved south, carrying a few possessions away from an area that had already been shattered by airstrikes before the full-scale invasion began. But the south proved to be no escape from peril. An investigation by the New York Times found that Israel had used some of the most destructive bombs in its arsenal there. Mr. Netanyahu says that Israel intends to minimize civilian casualties while fighting Hamas. An Israeli official said that Hamas fighters had set up checkpoints to prevent people from complying with the orders to move. And we are going to move over now to the Hartford Courant. And the first story I have is a proposal to enshrine a right, this is on the front page, to abortion and gender-affirming health care in the Connecticut State Constitution has received vehement criticism from religious and conservative groups who oppose the measure. Ahead of a public hearing in the Government Administration and Elections Committee Monday, residents and activists submitted more than 200 pieces of testimony in opposition to the proposal that, if enacted, would amend the Equal Protection Clause of the Connecticut Constitution to include an explicit right to abortion and gender-affirming health care. The Connecticut Constitution currently reads, quote, "No person shall be denied the equal protection of the law and be subjected to segregation or discrimination in the exercise or enjoyment of his or her civil or political rights because of religion, race, color, ancestry, national origin, sex, or physical or mental disability." The proposed amendment would be add additional language that states, quote, "Discrimination in the exercise or enjoyment of civil or political rights because of sex includes, but is not limited to, discrimination in interest or effect based on pregnancy, including preventing, initiating, continuing, or terminating a pregnancy, sexual orientation, gender identity, and expressions, and related health care." Committee Chair Senator Max Flexer said that this amendment would protect access to reproductive health care, same-sex marriage, and other freedoms that she described as currently under threat from a right-wing extremist United States Supreme Court. Flexer said that the proposal would ensure that Connecticut residents' rights to be an equal and full citizen in this state will be protected no matter who serves in the state house or in the Senate. In far too many states in this country, people's rights are going up and down, backwards and forwards, based on the whims of legislators, and that's just not how it should be. People should have some continuity in knowing what's protected, Fletcher said. While it's important that people understand elections have consequences, I think that there are certain things that should be protected as equal rights no matter what, and that's why we're advancing this amendment, Flexer added. I'm going to go to the weather now. I have the national forecast from the New York Times, and then I will have the local forecast after a short break. National forecast from the Times. A storm will spread snow across the interior northeast and Great Lakes today, while lake effect snow will continue along the western Great Lakes. Any heavier snow showers in these regions may reduce visibility briefly. From Pennsylvania to southern New England, precipitation will fall mainly as rain showers. Thunderstorms may develop in Texas and Oklahoma during the afternoon and at night. Some thunderstorms may become strong enough to produce damaging wind gusts and hail, mainly in the Texas Panhandle and Oklahoma. Portions of Colorado and New Mexico will have rain or snow showers. Farther north, a storm will bring showers to the northwest. A clipper storm will spread snow from Montana to North Dakota before reaching Minnesota. And we'll take a break and then have the local forecast.
Join us Saturdays at 5:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2:30 p.m. for the Reader's Digest. I'm Chris.
The forecast for tonight has a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly clear, with a low around 25. Chance of precipitation is 30%. Tomorrow, Thursday, will be mostly sunny, with a high near 39. And tomorrow night, mostly clear, with a low around 22. Friday will be sunny, with a high near 44. And Friday night, there's a chance of snow and rain, mostly cloudy, with a low around 31. Chance of precipitation is 60%, and little or no snow accumulation is expected. Saturday will have rain, with a high near 45. Chance of precipitation is 90%. And Saturday night, rain is likely, mostly before 9 p.m. It'll be mostly cloudy, with a low around 31. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
And going back to the front page of the Current, with the restaurant industry largely back on its feet after the coronavirus pandemic, a key legislative committee voted Tuesday to increase the minimum wage for workers who receive tips. For years, Connecticut has had a two-tiered system where about 70,000 tipped workers currently receive a reduced minimum wage because their tips boost their overall compensation beyond the minimum wage. But Democrats on the state legislature's Labor Committee voted to gradually eliminate that system over 3 years and pay workers the regular minimum wage that is currently $15.69 per hour in Connecticut. The federal minimum wage remains at only $7.25 per hour, and workers argue that Connecticut needs increased wages as a high-cost state. Opponents argue that the proposed change would amount to a 125% wage increase over several years to be paid by Connecticut restaurants. Advocates, though, counter that the wage has been stagnated for so long that a large increase is necessary. Republicans repeatedly cited a survey that was released by the State Restaurant Association, which said the servers prefer the current system and do not want to change it. Representative David Iacarino, a North Haven Republican and longtime small business owner, ripped the bill as a bad idea. In the industry, the workers don't want it. They don't need it, Iacarino told colleagues during the meeting. Government says they need it. With all due respect, this is one of the worst pieces of legislation that I've seen in my life. It will cause people to go out of business. The restaurant business is very difficult. In good conscience, this is a horrible piece of legislation. That is all I have to say. Representative Tim Ackert, a Coventry Republican, said restaurant workers are making, quote, a pretty good wage, unquote, in a different industry. He goes on to say, changing the law now isn't going to make those employers any better. Ackert said it's not a windfall business to own. There probably will be a fee in lieu of a tip. But State Senator Julie Kushner, a former union leader who co-chairs the committee, said restaurants will not be able to charge a fee with no explanation because the new law will require what the service fee is for. We don't assume that it is going to happen in every case, Kushner said, noting that she has eaten in restaurants in other states with similar laws on tipped wages and has not seen a fee. State Representative Steve Ware, a Hebron Republican, said some of the advocates at a recent public hearing were from out of state, but many restaurant workers who receive tips in Connecticut do not want to see change. Under current law, servers whose tips are too low are guaranteed the minimum wage that must be paid by the restaurant owner, though employees say that doesn't always happen. Any employee is guaranteed to make that minimum wage by telling the owner that did not meet the minimum hourly wage. Weir said the owner is going to end up raising prices. People in the industry today like it the way it is. You see a lot of restaurants come and go. It's a tough industry. And I have one more story that's on the front page of the Current. A 13-year-old Connecticut boy suffering from leukemia and a host of other illnesses died after he suffered cardiac arrest in an ambulance that was not equipped to care for him, a lawsuit filed by his parents claims. That was one of the missteps. David Hale and Christina Bilko Hale claim led to the death of Logan Hale of Ridgefield on December 30th, 2021. Their lawsuit names Memorial Sloan Kettering's Cancer Center, where he was being treated for his cancer, Danbury Hospital, New Vance Health, New Vance Health Ambulance, Dr. Morgan Pines, Dr. Beth Knott, Dr. Craig Tenenbaum, and Lauren Smith, a physician assistant. The large number of defenders represent the complexity of the decisions that were made in the final days of Logan's life, which were laid out in the lawsuit filed in Superior Court in Bridgeport. According to his obituary, Logan was a football player and major fan of the Carolina Panthers. From the moment he picked up a football, and as a two-year-old, he never put it down. The obituary states he loved his football team and all his coaches and was always ready with encouraging words for his teammates. When he was unable to play, he would still attend practices and games to show his team support. Logan, an eighth grader at East Ridge Middle School, also was a black belt in Taekwondo, loved to skateboard and scooter, played basketball and lacrosse, and acted in independent films with commercials. Besides his parents, he leaves a brother, Ethan Hale. According to the lawsuit, Logan woke up with an abdominal pain on December 25, 2021, the day before his 13th birthday. His parents called Pines, the on-call physician at Memorial Sloan, who determined Logan had an inflammation of the small intestine and prescribed Tylenol. He determined Logan did not need to come to the hospital. Later, Logan's condition worsened, and he was taken to Danbury Hospital with shortness of breath, rapid and shallow breathing, hypoxia, cyanosis, abnormal and rapid heartbeat, and fever, the suit states. It was determined he had a lower than normal number of white and red blood cells. Tenenbaum diagnosed neutropenic fever and sepsis, the suit says. Tenenbaum then sought a consultation with Knott, according to the lawsuit, who directed Smith to do so. Smith found a number of symptoms, including fever, spots on his skin, shortness of breath, sepsis, chills, rigors, worsening tachycardia, and blood pressure between 180 and 190, the suit says. The doctors then made a plan to transport Logan to Memorial Sloan, but were told only basic life support ambulances were available, according to the complaint. The defendants were aware that Logan's condition had deteriorated since his arrival at the defendant Danbury Hospital, that he was not stable for transport to the defendant MSK, that a basic life support ambulance did not have proper and effective monitoring equipment, and the EMTs operating the New Vance ambulance were not trained nor capable of providing proper care, treatment, and monitoring, nor effective airway management and intubations, the lawsuit states. Continues that the defenders were aware that transporting Logan put him at risk and for further deterioration and death, the suit says. Logan was put in the New Vance ambulance staffed by two EMTs, but on the way he suffered a cardiac arrest. According to the complaint, stopped breathing and became unconscious. The EMTs made multiple attempts to intubate Logan, it states. Logan was transferred to an Impress ambulance and taken to a White Plains hospital, which was closer than Memorial Sloan, according to the suit. He was unresponsive on arrival, so he was taken to the pediatric intensive care unit at Westchester Medical Center in Van Hella, New York. There, Logan was found to be status post-cardiac arrest with multiple organ dysfunction and no eye movement in an immunocompromised state, and he was diagnosed with severe sepsis with septic shock, the suit says. Moving over to the world and nation section, former President Donald Trump has charged that Jewish people who vote for Democrats hate Israel and hate their religion, igniting a firestorm of criticism from the White House and Jewish leaders. Trump, in an interview Monday, had been asked about Democrats' growing criticism of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over his handling of the war in Gaza as the civilian death toll continues to mount. I actually think they hate Israel, Trump responded to his former aide, Sebastian Gorka. I think they hate Israel, and the Democrat Party hates Israel. Trump, who last week became the Republican Party presumptive nominee, went on to charge any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion, they hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves because Israel will be destroyed. The comments sparked immediate backlash from the White House, President Joe Biden's campaign, and Jewish leaders. The vast majority of Jewish Americans identify as Democrats, but Trump has often accused them of disloyalty, perpetuating what critics say is an anti-Semitic trope. At the White House, a statement from spokesperson Andrew Bates casts the comments as vile and unhinged anti-Semitic rhetoric without mentioning Trump by name, and anti-Semitic crimes as anti-Semitic crimes and acts of hate have increased across the world. Among them, the deadliest attack committed against Jewish people since the Holocaust. Leaders have an obligation to call hate what it is and bring Americans together against it, the statement said. There is no justification for spreading toxic false stereotypes and threaten fellow citizens. None. Biden's campaign said the only person who should be ashamed here is Donald Trump. Trump is getting to lose again this November because Americans are sick of his hateful resentment, personal attacks, and extreme agenda, and said spokesman James Singer. Story from Washington. President Joe Biden and congressional leaders on Tuesday announced that they had reached an agreement on this fiscal year's final set of spending bills. Now the question is how fast lawmakers can get the bills passed to avoid a partial government shutdown. While Biden said he'll sign the bill package as soon as he receives it, time is running short. Legislative staff needs time to finish the bill text, an arduous task. The House has a rule that lawmakers get 72 hours to review a bill before voting, and the Senate has never been known for its ability to sprint. Meanwhile, funding for several key agencies expires at midnight Friday. Work on the federal spending bills hit a late snag around funding for the Department of Homeland Security, but the contours of that bill were resolved late Monday. The action comes nearly 6 months into the fiscal year, with Congress still only halfway home in passing spending measures expected to total about $1.65 trillion. Lawmakers passed the first portion of spending bills in early March, representing about 30% of discretionary spending for the year. Now lawmakers are focused on the larger package, and in what has become routine, are brushing up against a shutdown deadline. The package is expected to provide about $885 billion for the Pentagon. It will also fund the Departments of Health and Human Services, Labor, and others. Overall, the two spending packages provide about a 3% boost for defense, while keeping non-defense spending roughly flat with the year before. That's in keeping with an agreement that former Speaker Kevin McCarthy worked out with the White House, which restricted spending for 2 years and suspended the debt ceiling into January 2025 so the federal government could continue paying its bills. We're going to take a break and then be back with more Front Pages.
Windsor's Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum, with the help of the Windsor Lions Club and Chris Radio, has set up 18 Chris Access readers describing various exhibits for low vision and print disabled individuals. With input from the low vision population and working with a teacher of low vision and print disabled individuals, we have also improved the accessibility of these readers with highly visible markers on the floor. To access the QR code, just open the camera option on your phone, scan the QR code, and press enter once the link is shown. Please be aware that cell phone coverage in Northwest Park, where the Tobacco Museum is located, is limited, so please stop by the archive building to get the Wi-Fi password. If you or someone you know are interested in using this unique feature, please call the Tobacco Museum at 860-285-1888 or email windsorconnecticutmuseum@gmail.com. The Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum is located in Windsor's Northwest Park,
135 Lang Road, and is open Fridays and Saturdays, noon to 4 p.m. through the last week of October.
Story from Washington, the top two U.S. generals who oversaw the evacuation of Afghanistan as it fell to the Taliban in August 2021 blamed the Biden administration for the chaotic departure, telling lawmakers Tuesday that it inadequately planned for the evacuation and did not order it in time. The rare testimony by the two retired generals publicly exposed for the first time the strain and differences the military leaders had with the Biden administration in the final days of the war. Two of those key differences included that the military had advised that the U.S. keep at least 2,500 service members in Afghanistan to maintain stability, and a concern that the State Department was not moving fast enough to get an evacuation started. The remarks contrasted with an internal White House review of the administration's effort that found President Joe Biden's decisions had been severely constrained by previous withdrawal agreements negotiated by former President Donald Trump's administration, and blamed the military, saying top commanders said that they had enough resources to handle the evacuation. 13 U.S. service members were killed by a suicide bomber at the Kabul airport's Abbey Gate in the final days of the war as the Taliban took over Afghanistan. Thousands of panicked Afghans and U.S. citizens desperately tried to get on U.S. military flights that were airlifting people out of the country. In the end, the military was able to rescue more than 130,000 civilians before the final U.S. military aircraft departed. That chaos was the end result of the State Department failing to call for an evacuation of U.S. personnel until it was too late, former Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley and retired General Frank McKenzie, formerly of U.S. Central Command, told the House Foreign Affairs Committee. On August 14th, the non-combatant evacuation operation decision was made by the Department of State, and the U.S. military alerted, marshaled, mobilized, and rapidly deployed faster than any military in the world could ever do. But the State Department's decision came too late, Milley said. The fundamental mistake, the fundamental flaw, was the timing of the State Department, Milley said. That was too slow and too late. Another story from Washington. Peter Navarro, a trade advisor to former President Donald Trump, reported to federal prison in Miami on Tuesday, becoming the first senior Trump administration official to serve time over his role in the effort to subvert the results of the 2020 election. Navarro, 74, who helped engineer Trump's plans to stay in power after his electoral defeat in November 2020, was sentenced to 4 months in prison in January for contempt of Congress after defying a subpoena from the House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 riot. At a hastily organized news conference shortly before he was set to check into the Federal Correctional Institution in Miami, a low-security prison next to the Miami-Dade Zoo, Navarro reprised familiar denunciations of the Justice Department and the Biden administration. Speaking in the parking lot of a commercial plaza flanked by a pizza arena and a pawn shop, he cast blame on the federal trial judge in the case, as well as President Joe Biden and a long list of politicians he said were motivated by hostility toward Trump. He asked that the tragedy of his situation was that he was likely to complete his sentence as he continues to appeal his conviction. I'm afraid of only one thing, he told reporters. I'm afraid for my country, because this, what they are doing, will have a chilling effect on every American, regardless of their party. Stan Mangle, a federal prison consultant who helped Navarro prepare for his surrender, said he was working to get Navarro into a unit devised for inmates over 60 in a minimum security satellite camp in the prison. Inmates there share bunks in an open 80-bed dormitory with minimal privacy, Mangle said, adding that given his age, Navarro hoped to fulfill his prison work requirements through a job as a law library clerk or another low-intensity position. Another story from the World and Nations section about the war in Ukraine. A decade ago, President Vladimir Putin seized Crimea from Ukraine, a bold land grab that set the stage for Russia to invade its neighbor in 2022. the quick and bloodless seizure of the diamond-shaped peninsula, home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet and a popular vacation site, touched off a wave of patriotism and sent Putin's popularity soaring. "Crimea is ours" became a popular slogan in Russia. Now that Putin has been anointed to another six-year term as president, he is determined to extend his gains in Ukraine amid Russia's battlefield successes and waning Western support for Kyiv. Putin has been vague about how much of Ukraine he wants as the fighting grinds into a third year at the expense of many lives on both sides. But some of his top lieutenants still talk of capturing Kyiv and cutting Ukraine's access to the Black Sea. The largest conflict in Europe since World War II has sent tensions between Moscow and the West soaring to levels rarely seen during even the chilliest moments of the Cold War. When he seized Crimea in 2014, Putin said he persuaded Western leaders to back down by reminding them of Moscow's nuclear capabilities. It's a warning he has issued often, notably after the start of his full-scale invasion in last month's State of the Nation address, when he declared that the West risks nuclear war if it deepens its involvement in Ukraine, and again March 13th, when he said he would use that arsenal if Russia's sovereignty is threatened. Analyst Tatiana Stronova says Putin feels more confident than ever amid the Kremlin's growing faith in Russia's military advantage in a war with Ukraine and a sense of the weakness and fragmentation of the West. The senior fellow at Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center noted that Putin's speech last month created an extremely chilling impression of an unraveling spiral of escalation. Putin, 71, has cast the war in Ukraine as a life-or-death battle against the West, with Moscow ready to protect its gains at any cost. His obsession with Ukraine was clear in an interview with U.S. conservative commentator Tucker Carlson, with Putin delivering a long lecture that sought to prove his claim that the bulk of its territory historically belonged to Russia. He made the argument 10 years ago when he said Moscow needed to protect Russian leaders in Crimea and reclaim its territory. A divided Supreme Court on Tuesday allowed Texas to begin enforcing a law that gives police broad powers to arrest migrants suspected of crossing the border illegally, while a legal battle over the measure plays out. The conservative majority's order rejects an emergency application from the Biden administration, which says the law is a clear violation of federal authority that would upset more than a century of immigration authority. Texas Governor Greg Abbott praised the order and the law, which allows any police officer in Texas to arrest migrants for illegal entry and authorizes judges to order them to leave the country. The high court didn't address whether the law is constitutional. The measure now goes back to an appellate court and could eventually return to the Supreme Court. In the meantime, it wasn't clear how soon Texas might begin arresting migrants under the law. The decision to let the law go into effect drew dissents from liberal justices Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor. The court gives a green light to a law that will upend the longstanding federal-state balance of power and sow chaos, Sotomayor wrote in a blistering dissent joined by Jackson. Opponents say the law, known as Senate Bill 4, is the most dramatic attempt by a state to police immigration since an Arizona law more than a decade ago, portions of which were struck down by the Supreme Court. Critics have also said the Texas law could lead to civil rights violations and racial profiling. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre called the law harmful and unconstitutional and said it would burden law enforcement while creating confusion. She called on congressional Republicans to settle the issue with a federal border security bill. Texas, for its part, has argued it has a right to take action over what authorities have called an ongoing crisis in the southern border. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice said in a statement it is, quote, prepared to handle any influx in population, end quote, associated with the state law. Mexico's government said Tuesday it would not, under any circumstances, accept the return of any migrants to its territory from the state of Texas. And I have a couple of news briefings. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster held a ceremony Tuesday to spotlight a new law allowing any adult who can legally own a gun to carry the weapon openly without a permit. McMaster signed the bill into law 12 days ago, as soon as it hit his desk, allowing open carry for before the ink had dried. Tuesday's State House event outside his office was a day to let everyone who pushed for the law to take a victory lap. "This is a happy day. It's a good step forward," the Republican governor said. "Officers can no longer stop someone who is just carrying a gun, and anyone carrying a concealed weapon is no longer required to tell an officer they are armed. Concealed weapons permits are still available, and the bill makes the training free across the state. The law also allows anyone ages 18 to 20 who doesn't have a felony conviction or other legal problem to carry a gun." And in Haiti, Caribbean leaders said Tuesday that all groups and political parties except one have submitted nominees for a transitional presidential council charged with selecting an interim prime minister for Haiti, which remains engulfed in gang violence. The original 9-member council was whittled down to 8 members after the Pit Desalin Party, led by former senator and presidential candidate Jean-Charles Moïse, declined a seat last week. Moïse is allied with Guy Philippe, a former police official and rebel leader who served time in the U.S. after pleading guilty to money laundering. The December 21st group, which is allied with Prime Minister Ariel Henry, was one of the latest holdouts, submitting a name Monday to the regional trade group known as CARICOM. Henry, who remains locked out of Haiti because ongoing gang violence has forced the closure of its main international airport, has promised to resign once the transitional council is created. And we're going to move over now to the Connecticut section of the Current for the rest of our stories. And the first one I have is: avian influenza has been in the country since 1996 and remains a concern with the spring migration season ahead. The virus can be found in wild birds and can spread to domestic birds. The Connecticut Department of Agriculture is reminding backyard and commercial flock owners of proper biosecurity measures to keep both people and birds healthy. Coastal states like Connecticut have waterfowl that are a natural reservoir of the virus. Connecticut State veterinarian Dr. Jane Lewis said, "Highly pathogenic avian influenza is a strain of the virus that is highly contagious among domestic poultry and has a mortality rate among birds approaching 100%, authorities said. The U.S. Department of Agriculture said it confirmed highly pathogenic avian influenza in a commercial flock in the United States in February 2022. The State Department of Agriculture is advising residents who are adding to their flock with chicks and ducklings. "We have import requirements," Lewis said. "Most people are purchasing day-old chicks, and your birds are commonly shipped to homes from local feed stores. Most birds are purchased from flocks in the National Poultry Improvement Plan, or NPIP, and are tested and healthy. Birds that are imported must meet strict state requirements as official health certificate from the state of exportation and a permit issued by the Commissioner of Agriculture is required." Lewis said when everyone implements and practices biosecurity measures, it reduces the risk of people, animals, and equipment carrying infectious diseases from one place to another. We're going to take our final break and be back with the rest of the front pages after that.
If you're over 70, you may have a hidden asset you don't even know about. You could sell your unwanted life insurance policy and pay off health care bills or supplement your retirement income. You get a cash payment, often 4 to 7 times more than the cash surrender value, while the purchaser assumes all future premium payments and eventually gets the benefit. This is known as a life settlement, explains the nonprofit Life Insurance Settlement Association. Learn more, including whether you're eligible, at lisa.org.
Providers who work for religiously affiliated hospitals or other healthcare centers and provide counseling or referrals on reproductive care would be protected from dismissal, suspension, or penalties under a bill that is being considered by the legislature's Public Health Committee. The measure would shield providers who offer information and counseling about contraception, termination of pregnancy, gender-affirming care, and other reproductive health care, and who offer referrals for treatment. Supporters called the proposal a good next step in the expansion of Connecticut's protections for reproductive rights. Legislation passed in 2022 made Connecticut a legal, safe harbor state for those who travel here from another state to receive an abortion and for the clinicians who perform them. It also expanded the type of providers who can perform first trimester abortions to include nurse midwives, advanced practice registered nurses, and physical assistants. Last year, lawmakers passed a bill protecting medical providers in Connecticut who face disciplinary action in other states for performing abortions. Under the measure, those providers could not be denied a license, have their license revoked, or be denied privileges here based solely on their out-of-state sanctions. The measure now before the Public Health Committee would not require physicians to provide counseling or referrals, but would shield those who want to offer those services. While providers at Catholic health institutions may be barred from providing reproductive care and gender-affirming care under the institution's directives, they can also face employment repercussions simply for giving their patients accurate information about their health and where they can access care, Liz Gustafson, Connecticut State Director of Reproductive Equity, now said in a written testimony. The lack of any information sharing about where else a patient might be able to go to seek care can lead to devastating delays. Patients may not even be aware that a healthcare facility would deny them both healthcare services and medically accurate information regarding their health. To combat this chilling effect and prevent delays in care, Connecticut can ensure that providers at these institutions who may wish to share medically accurate and appropriate information with a patient about their health status, recommended treatment, or offer possible referrals will not face retaliation. In an interview, Gustafson said federal refusal laws pose a threat to people who rely on religiously affiliated health centers, especially in rural areas where there may be few alternatives. She pointed to the proposed acquisition in 2022 of Day Kimball Healthcare in Putnam by Massachusetts-based Covenant Health, a Catholic health system. The sale, which ultimately was canceled, drew opposition, with critics saying it would limit care in the region. Our communities understand just how detrimental these refusal laws can be to people's ability to access care or referrals in certain areas of our state, Gustafson said. Connecticut is home to several Catholic hospitals. Trinity Health operates St. Francis Hospital in Hartford, Johnson Memorial Hospital in Safford, and St. Mary's Hospital in Waterbury. Nancy Stanwood, Chief Medical Officer for Planned Parenthood of Southern New England, said that when patients go to the hospital, they should be confident their health care providers are allowed to offer the best care possible without fear of repercussions. During a time when other states have created climates of fear, intimidation, and uncertainty for providers caring for patients experiencing pregnancy complications, this bill would make it crystal clear that science, providers, and patients are respected and protected in Connecticut, she said. While state legislators are trying to reduce fatalities on Connecticut highways, they haven't been able to agree on the next steps regarding drivers smoking pot or drinking alcohol. Republicans said that marijuana is a major problem on the highways, but their amendment to make it easier for police officers to pull over pot-smoking drivers was defeated by the Democratic-controlled committee by 19-14. The amendment was part of a broader bill to lower the threshold for arrests for drunken driving from a blood alcohol concentration of 0.08% to 0.05%. The only state that currently has the 0.05 level is Utah, but lawmakers also could not reach a broad consensus on alcohol as Democrats and Republicans split on the issue that passed narrowly. Republicans said they do not believe it is a coincidence that fatalities have increased since the legislature approved the decriminalization of marijuana in June 2021. But lawmakers from both parties said they lack detailed information regarding the impact of marijuana on accidents. Retail sales of marijuana did not become legal in Connecticut until January 2023, and comprehensive statistics are not available in real time. Democrats noted that the state now has 72 drug recognition experts who can check for impairment and will be better able to document marijuana use. Lawmakers are examining a package of bills to improve road safety as the Transportation Committee faces a deadline Friday on short legislative sessions that ends on May 8th. Representative Thomas O'Day, a new Canaan Republican, cited a provision that was passed as part of the marijuana law that says that the odor of cannabis or burnt cannabis cannot be used as the sole reason for probable cause for an officer to pull over a driver. That's insanity. It defies logic, O'Day told committee members. We argued this on the floor of the House. It makes no sense. If a police officer sees a person drinking a beer while driving, the police can use that as probable cause to pull that person over. If a police officer observes a person holding a bong in their hand and the police officer sees that, they can pull the person over for holding a bong or a roach. My understanding is they can't. Representative Roland Lamar, a New Haven Democrat who co-chairs the committee, said the driver could be pulled over for reckless driving if that was the case. That's the reason why I'm so apoplectic about this is because of other issues, O'Day said. We're literally encouraging people to smoke marijuana and gummies. Just don't drink. And we wonder why there are more deaths on our highways. In one of the contentious issues of the day, O'Day offered an amendment to change the state law and allow police officers to stop drivers if they see the driver has been using marijuana. It allows a police officer, if they see someone smoking marijuana, you can pull them over. O'Day said, if you see a driver smoking dope, you can pull him over. This, I guarantee you, will save lives. I know I'm a little passionate about this. If you really want to impact the safety of our roadways, this will do it. In Stanford, O'Day said, when I am walking to buy lunch, I smell marijuana coming out of vehicles. In my final story, there's a new brewery in Connecticut, Dead Language Beer Project, opened in Hartford with the aim of bringing a little bit of Europe to the city's booming Parkville neighborhood. The brewery and tap room, located at 1429 Park Street at the former Hog River Brewing Space, offers cafe-style ambiance with an emphasis on European lagers. The brewery is a dream come true for owners Chris and Kyle DeGassero. The pair announced last week on their Facebook page. Chris and I went to Prague over the summer, and the drinking culture there was so inspirational to us, Kyle DeGassero said. They drink very low alcohol beers until they drink in large glasses. They're also very affordable there, so even during the workday, you see people out having a beer with their lunch. It's very normal there. They also are drinking in places that look more like coffee shops, so we brought that with us with the comfy setting and seating. The tap room is furnished with dozens of mixed-matched antique and donated furniture items, tables, chairs, bookcases, stools, and couches that create a relaxed atmosphere. Exposed concrete walls of the century-old apartment complex The lofts on Park give it a modern industrial setting that pays homage to the city's past. Everything in here, I can tell you exactly where it came from, Kyle said. We had a lot of things donated from friends and family. We went to a lot of auctions and did a lot of thrifting. We got stuff on Facebook Marketplace. Every piece has a story. We wanted to create that coffee shop atmosphere with the furniture. The rapid success of breweries, with more than 100 popping up across the state in recent years, have made the business more challenging for new owners to find success.